Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we are going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever. Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com. Nintex is the global standard for business process management and automation. The Nintex platform helps their clients accelerate progress on their digital transformation journeys by quickly and easily managing, automating, and optimizing business processes. Learn more at nintex.com.
Thanks, everybody. This is Sean Martin, Editor-in-Chief for ITSP Magazine. You're very welcome to a new Redefining Security episode here on ITSP Radio. And today's topic is all about threat hunting. And we recently did an episode on the day in the life of a cyber threat intelligence analyst, where clearly the two are very connected. And there was a thread on Twitter by Taz Wake, and I'll include the link in the show notes, that kind of prompted this idea that what's the value of threat hunting and why do we even bother doing it? And I figured this could be a good conversation. So I've asked three folks to join me and I'm thrilled they all said yes. And we're going to have a good conversation. So we have Alexis Wales. She's a Deputy Associate Director for Threat Hunting in the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. We have Lauren Prale. She's threat hunting for a Fortune 200. Lauren, you can choose to disclose who that company is if you like when you say a few words. And then we also have Neil Grifter Weiler, who's threat hunting and incident response specialist for RSA Security, who many of you have heard on the show before as well. So thanks all three of you to taking the time to have this conversation with me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
All right, so quick round of intros, because I could certainly not do justice to all the good stuff the three of you are doing. So Alexis, we'll kick it off with you. What are you up to?
Sure, thank you. And I'm actually really looking forward to being on this particular podcast. I've listened to the previous podcasts, very interesting topics, very timely topics. So I work for the Department of Homeland Security. I'm part of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. We're a new agency. We're about 2 years old. We're an outgrowth of a previous directorate that the department has housed since the stand-up of the of the Department of Homeland Security. Cybersecurity is the mission space that I focus on. I'm within our cybersecurity division, but the kind of overarching theme of the CISA, as we call it, agency is the provisioning of protective information, risk management guidance to all of the critical infrastructure that exists within the United States. So we have a very robust population that we service and that we provide risk guidance to. Risk guidance, everyone on this podcast knows, is comprised of threat intelligence, of vulnerability information, of consequence focuses, understanding the impact. And with that very large population, which is private and public sector, asset owners, network owners, et cetera, comes a very large attack surface. So Sean, as we go into your questions, we can get into our specific definition of threat hunting and how we look at it from a national security or a homeland security perspective and how we've evolved it over the past 10 years or so. Maybe a little bit longer from the days of the U.S. and the ICS, Industrial Control Systems, CERTs. We are an outgrowth of that. We are an evolution of those entities. And in our refined processes, I very much agreed with the post that you sent to us, the Twitter post, some of the sentiments defined there. And we can talk to some of what I experience in my daily job and then within our team's jobs and what we find out in the very vast landscape that we service. Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much. And it is vast and it covers both public and private. So I'm thrilled that we have representation from both to cover that vast landscape. Lauren, a little bit about what you're up to.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here. Lauren Prale, I'm mainly in the private sector. So this is now my second threat hunting team that I've set up. I'm not going to say my company just because not sure I can get away with that. But I was formerly in the public ISP space, and now I'm in the financial vertical. And technically, I'm a manager of threat intelligence, but I have both threat hunting and threat intel under me. And super excited. Threat hunting is the thing that I'm most passionate about in the cybersecurity space. I think it's awesome. I think it's emerging. And I think having more conversations like these will help shed some light on this topic, because I do think it's like the hot new, you know, buzzword that people want to talk about, and not a lot of people actually know the details. So having these conversations can really help with that and encourage folks to get into more threat hunting and building threat hunting teams.
Yep. Love it. Yeah. And it does seem to be a hot topic, and which really raised the question for me, well, are people doing it because it's cool and fun, or is there actual value coming from it? Which is what we're going to get into. Before we do that, Neil, for those who don't know you.
Sure. So hi, my name is Neil Weiler. In the information security community, I'm better known as Grifter. By day, I am a principal threat hunter at RSA. And by night, I run all the technical operations for the Black Hat security briefings. I've been doing that for about 18 years. And I'm also one of the lead organizers of DEF CON. I sit on the Black Hat review board to help select the content as well as DEF CON. And I don't know, I speak at conferences all over the world. I'm an oddly weird extroverted introvert. I don't know if that's a thing. High functioning introvert, in that I can get up on stage and present to a room full of people, but then I go hide in my hotel room after.
I think, take the stage away, and we probably share similar traits there. So, well, listen, let's get into it. And Alexis, you kind of brought the first question to bear when you were introducing yourself, the definition of the purpose of threat hunting. So I'd like to get your description first, your views for that, and then Lauren and Grifter can chime in with any additional points.
So I will say this. When something is really starting to trend, usually the government's like 5 years behind. So it's actually kind of amazing to me that we have named ourselves something that may be somewhat trendy, because again, usually from a Homeland Security perspective, our naming convention just showcases that we're like 5 years behind industry. So it's interesting. Like I said in my previous remarks, we are the outgrowth of the US CERT, and we are the outgrowth of what we were trying to do to be kind of the national level computer intrusion, computer emergency readiness team when the department stood up. And over time, over the past decade or so, we have evolved our own understanding of what the need is from the populations that we service. And over the past 2 years or so, have rebranded kind of anything related to threat intelligence, threat analysis, detection, all sorts of CND, computer network defense, all of that tradecraft into threat hunting. And we have refined our approach to be very purely intelligence driven. This was a big change for DHS for the way that we did our work. The US CERT was kind of a consumer of incident reports. Things were being sent to us. We were not necessarily, especially at the beginning when we first stood up our organization, competent enough in our processes, in our analytic tradecraft to create that full intelligence-driven incident response or threat hunting life cycle and make it into an organization that could then service at scale. Especially when you're starting to talk a little bit about public sector and then private sector, because those are two different groups of entities with different authorities that we have in the government in order to work with them or to outfit them with different kind of technological, you know, sensor grids, things like that. We have different ways that we have to approach those two teams. So when we really took on this threat hunting organization and started to define ourselves more clearly, we had to be very active and proactive in ways that I can relate to what the other panelists have already said about. We were a team of extreme introverts. We were very comfortable receiving reporting and then quietly kind of doing our business and then sending out security alerts or security guidance or mitigation reports. We are now much more extroverted in our approach to getting the word out of what we mean by threat hunting. We are truly hunting for threats, and we are primarily hunting for the undetectable. So we have partnered tightly with our intelligence community, with our law enforcement partners, with the private sector, in order to create a full life cycle that is driven by intelligence in order to service in a threat hunting approach those that either warrant our interest or call us because they believe something is occurring and we agree with them. And then we either remote or deploy and begin the conduct of threat hunting. And I'd like to hear from the other panelists of how they describe it, but ours is very pure, what we mean by threat hunting.
And Grifter, I'd like to turn to you. And a lot of my own views on this and what I've read in the tweet thread, if you will, seems to be very incident oriented, kind of getting ahead of the incident and being very response oriented. Is that the case, or so, is there another gap that it's also filling?
I think. Well, for me, threat hunting is you can define it as essentially just like proactively searching for things that are blinky boxes and stuff that we put in place don't detect by default, right? So rather than relying on alerts or relying on those incidents that come into a queue that an analyst is taking out, threat hunting means, you know, proactively sitting down behind a keyboard, a human, not a script, not a device that you picked up on an expo floor somewhere, but a human with a varied skill set, coming, you know, up with an idea of, okay, let me create a hypothesis around what I think would be the way that we would be attacked, or areas that I believe that we're weak, and then going and searching in those places to see if there's activity that somebody else also got that idea and they just happen to execute on that. It's essentially like a lot of the stuff that we talk about with threat hunting. It sounds like, you know, it's a great term, right? It sounds really cool, threat hunting. But it's essentially doing incident response before you know that you're owned. We do a lot of the same processes. We're just assuming that an attacker persists within the environment without knowing that they're actually there. And so we get into an investigative mindset. We start looking for things that would be the artifacts of tools that an attacker might use, or evidence of a new technique that attackers are using. And we go look for that within the environment without evidence that it's already taking place. And, you know, there are plenty of times where you come up with nothing, which is, I'll just say, like, a positive. We don't always want to find something, right? But, you know, going out and proactively looking means that we are getting ahead of the issue. It allows us to not be constantly reactive, to not be tied to some alert that's coming in, but allows us to put ourselves in a mindset that says, what do I think is the actual threat to our organization? Or what do I think is the threat to these particular assets? Determine what that risk is, and then go look for evidence of some type of attack or attempt on that asset. It's, I can say, as somebody who once was an analyst and is now a hunter, it's incredibly rewarding to be able to work in that way. So you know, I will also say too, the term threat hunting is fairly new, and in only recent years we've started calling it threat hunting. But the things that we're doing are not necessarily new, right? We're searching through things based off of intelligence that we're receiving from different sources. We're stack counting things for outliers and anomalies. So the techniques may not necessarily be new, but the overall umbrella around it and the way that we're creating a structure around it or a methodology around it, that is what's new.
So Lauren, one of the points is that there's always been the need to find the things that technology isn't finding, and technology and data analytics has become, they've been proved over the years. So, but that doesn't eliminate the need for a person to do this work. So perhaps, and I want to touch on the thing that Grifter also noted, that you may not find anything, right? So as we start to lean into the measurement, what does success mean? Maybe just a quick additional thought on from you on the purpose of threat hunting, and then how do we begin to define success? How do we know that we're doing something good if in fact something good could be we don't find anything?
Yeah, absolutely. So my definition is kind of similar to Neil's about threat hunting, except I sometimes add the addition of like, well, we might be looking for gaps in processes or, misconfigurations in our technology stack or missing rules, those type of things. My adage that I tell all of my threat hunters is, look, it's very, very, very hard to find absolutely nothing when you're threat hunting. Just point blank, it might be that, hey, we know this rule that's detecting Mimikatz for some reason isn't going off, or, hey, yeah, we found an, APT. And that's a rarer case, right? But there's always something to find. So I like to use threat hunting for both, and then make sure that I have the appropriate teams to work with. And it really is like incident response, just proactively. But the measurements are also really interesting because, again, this is a newer term, even though we've been doing it for a while. And I would say as a whole, metrics in cybersecurity, even like in a SOC, which is where my background is in, those metrics are fairly new. And I think there's more and more metrics being discussed, and people are talking about the importance of measuring success more these days. But even as an industry as a whole, we're still immature. And so that measurement is still difficult. For me, I've always said that it's not the number of threat hunts that you do. It's the actionable impact that you have from your threat hunts. I'm very cautious about turning proactive teams into ticket factories. I'm also cautious about turning IR teams or SOC teams into ticket factories, just because saying you worked 30,000 tickets last year is not necessarily an indication of, hey, we actually stopped the bad guys or responded quickly. I also like to measure against relevance in where we are starting our threat hunts from. So threat hunting is a lot of fun. I love doing it. But if you are hunting for some Trojan that only affects Iranian oil companies, and you are in the construction industry in Canada, that probably isn't going to have as much relevance to you as maybe another global threat. It's very, very frustrating to see that. So you have to balance the relevancy with, global attack trends and things that you want to do.
But presumably, you only know that it only affects energy sector if you analyze it. So at some point, you have to dig in to understand what the impact may be versus knowing that the impact doesn't apply, right?
Yep, exactly.
And I don't know who wants to take this, but it was interesting, Lauren, that you described the process looking at misconfigurations as well, which wouldn't necessarily seem to me like it would fall into threat hunting. And it brought up the idea of, well, where's the line drawn between risk assessment teams versus pen testing versus response versus threat hunting? Are there clear lines there?
I think that's the thing about about being a hunter is if, you know, if this was a Venn diagram, we would fall somewhere between a bunch of different circles. Because I agree wholeheartedly that, that essentially what we're doing when we're out there hunting is, yes, we're trying to find, you know, really bad things, right? We're trying to find some attacker who is in the environment, or evidence that attacker has been in the environment. But what we're also doing while we're doing those things are finding, you know, identifying gaps within, you know, our security. We're finding those misconfigurations and things. And overall, what we're trying to do is twofold. One, if an attacker is in the environment, we're trying to reduce the dwell time that they persist within the environment. So we're not ending up on the news talking about, and the attacker was there for 3 years, right? But we're also just trying to reduce the attack surface so that when, you know, attackers are looking for candidates, if we're not directly targeted as an individual, but attackers are out there conducting business and they're looking for soft targets, we're a lot more of a difficult target to come after because our attack surface has been whittled away at thanks to the work, you know, of the hunters. And I think, like, when it comes to metrics, that is one of the biggest metrics that you can deliver back to management to say, like, here's the value that we're getting out of threat hunting. Because if you keep coming to them saying, here's all the compromised hosts I found, here's the attackers that, you know, were in our environment, you know, they're going to be like, why do we have all of these attackers in the environment? So I don't know if that necessarily smells like success to me, but going to them and saying, like, we identified gaps in our logging, or we discovered some vulnerabilities and we were able to work with this team to escalate it and get it resolved before it became a problem. Or, you know, we talked about having a hypothesis and working through something like that, like documenting, here are the ideas that we had about where attackers might be targeting us. And we went and looked at them and we found these things. We discovered that when we have deployed this infrastructure in our network, it means that the protocols work this way or talk to each other this way. We found things that we thought could potentially be an attacker, but it turned out that for us, that's normal. And those are important things to learn about your environment, because it means that when an attacker comes in, if you know your environment very, very well, then they're going to stick out to you like a sore thumb, right? So we want to write down all the misconfigurations we find, all the vulnerabilities we discover, all the different hypotheses that we come up with and how we work through them. If we discover, you know, some IOC that we want to use in, or create a new playbook in our automation solution, or create another alert, those things are things that we can use as metrics to deliver back to management to say, like, look, we didn't find, like, you know, in the last 6 months, we haven't found a single attacker within our environment, but we have closed all of these gaps. We've discovered these vulnerabilities and escalated and resolved them. We've learned these different things about the way that our environment works. We've shored up our defenses on, you know, what we deploy as a golden image out to the hosts on our, you know, within our environment. All of those things are valuable to the organization. If you just go up to a hunter and you say, how many attackers did you find in that 6 hours that you hunted today? And they go, none. You know, that seems like an odd value. But if they can come back and say, here's all the things that we did find. And I agree with Oren, where if you are, you know, if you are going and looking for those misconfigurations and finding those gaps and shoring those things up, that is an incredibly valuable part of what a threat hunter's job is.
Yeah, Lauren, Alexis, feel free to jump in with anything you want to add.
I would say that from my perspective, obviously agreeing with Lauren and Neil, the government loves to count things, and we kind of count the easiest things to count. So we had to actually kind of coach ourselves and coach our oversight bodies away from trying to do comparison counts. And what I mean by that within our cybersecurity universe is, you know, just like Neil was kind of talking to, folks want to see higher and higher numbers of completed hunts or completed incident response activities. And I would even say, regardless of whether or not we kind of said, oh, and we found something on 5 of the 10, that wasn't necessarily the full thought process that we were having. It was more, how many did you conduct? We gave you X dollars, you did this many. We have a big pile of beans in a different category in Homeland Security's CISA, where we are able to do at scale and at very, very high numbers vulnerability assessments or vulnerability scans. So when we're talking to our oversight committees, we're constantly saying, oh, we did 1,000 scans and had all these findings. And then we did 10 hunts and we had 0 findings. And of course, we have a very expensive price tag that goes along with threat hunting. So over time, we've started to resolve this by working through a much better way of measuring and explaining the success story from a Homeland Security perspective, right? So this is really talking about Homeland Security and our ability to take the information that we're gleaning when we're spending time on a site or at a particular asset or at a collection of assets, maybe a collection of hospitals. And when we do find something, and of course we find misconfigurations, things like that all the time, we're providing that information back to our partner on the vulnerability side, and they're developing plugins or enhancing modules that they have so that they can scan at scale for that particular misconfiguration if able, and then can come back with additional findings. So we've really had to kind of take the role of threat hunting within the broader ecosystem of what it means to do and provide cybersecurity services and tell it as a cohesive, comprehensive story. I do agree with the other speakers that threat hunting is always kind of the sexier one because honestly, it does sound very cool. And we have some really, really top talent that we've managed to recruit in order to be that kind of primary workforce when it comes to threat hunting and to lead the engagement teams. And one of the successes that I personally really like to talk about is when they go on site and they are able to detect something that no one else could detect, none of the other security stack or security apparatus that was deployed in that particular asset or piece of infrastructure was able to find. We come back, we look at what we did, and we create some type of a tool or other way of detecting it at scale, and we get that back out to our communities of interest or the communities we can share with. That, again, then gives us a higher level of prevalency. Perhaps we can then go make contact with another piece of infrastructure, another part of the puzzle that's really getting us that whole idea of what's going on behind that campaign. But it takes talent and it takes a lot of hard work in order to get those gems. Once we have them, we don't just stockpile them and say we did 10 of these. It's about kind of deconstructing that information, those findings, and looking at all the different ways we can use it to then do more and find more. Across all the different entities that we are servicing.
Yeah, I love it. And I'm gonna list a few things here, kind of going off of, you said you get a budget to do so many hunts, and then you go off and do it. And this might kick off a bit of a conversation across the three of you. The questions are, how do you scope, and how do you ensure that scope is relevant? How do you capture and document what you find, and then what do you do with those findings, and how do you learn from a hunt to either make the next one better? Assuming one of the items in the Twitter thread was don't rerun the same hunt over and over and over. So how do you learn from the hunt itself? And maybe this is all BS because maybe there is no hunt. Maybe it's just an ongoing thing. Maybe that's a misconception on my part. So, given that, how do you proceed with threat hunting as an organization, and how do you answer the scope, documenting, capturing, communicating the findings and learning?
Yeah, so one of the most important things for me whenever we talk about threat hunting is that there is a process, should be very process driven, like similar to the scientific method. You need to start with a hypothesis. And really, that's just to have guardrails in place for your threat hunters or for yourself, whoever's actually conducting the hunt, to help guide you and say, like, this is where I'm going next. because it's really easy to like end up having 85 spin-off hunts when you find a log that's particularly interesting. You're like, oh, okay, I'm going down this rabbit hole after rabbit hole. So I'm a big fan of just setting up processes in place. For actually the hunt question, I think hunting is a continuous process. You should continue iterating and doing hunts. I don't think you should do the same hunts over and over again, because you don't want to spend the same valuable human experience time on the same topics if you have findings that can be fixing that. But I do think hunts should operate kind of in their own timeline. So each hunt for me is unique. And the scoping question is a great question. Generally, how I scope hunts is like technology domain. So an endpoint hunt, a network hunt, things like that. Just to manage the timeline effectively, I tend to find the minimum for a formalized threat hunt is about 30 days. You need to give people time to like get into the topic, understand it, research, play around with their queries, look at different log sources, those types of things. And when you start talking about hunting like actual threat actors, that's when you get into multiple months, potentially even years, hunting, because you're following an attacker from the beginning of their attack life cycle to the end. There's a lot that goes into that. So scoping by technology domain, scoping with a reasonable timeline according to what my executives and I have already agreed upon. So again, part of this is just having a preparation phase before starting your hunt, or before kicking off threat hunting in general. And then tracking everything in a ticket or a OneNote or a shared notebook where you just record everything that you do meticulously. What queries did you run? What tool did you run those queries in? What time did you run those queries in? Did you have to do any emulation in order to like see what the behavior looks like in your particular environment? And then at the end, what we do is have a full report similar to a penetration test report, where we walk through all of the findings, all of the queries that we ran, and then all of the recommendations ranked by priority. And my hope is that if I hand that to a new threat hunter that walks into my team, they'll be able to look at all the steps that I ran and all the information and rerun that hunt themselves without much guidance needed.
Yeah, I agree with Lauren. So obviously coming from a government perspective and then interacting with either another public sector component or the private sector, everything has to be like, you know, discussed with lawyers in advance in terms of what will be the scope of that engagement. And we're talking both time frame, how invasive will we get, what does their technology environment look like. There's a whole lot of things that go into preparation before obviously the US government can conduct any type of threat hunting activity. And that makes us also, it forces us into being really on point when it comes to documenting exactly what we do or how we've done it. But we do that also because, you know, like Lauren was saying, we're also creating playbooks for what comes next, and we're creating detections and tools for whoever's going out next. And we're always kind of innovating and creating better versions of what we call our kit. You know, what we're going to take out, whether it's going to be remote or we're actually taking a physical kit with us when we deploy to a site. That is a constantly evolving, very intelligent process in and of itself that allows for us to get better each time we move forward. And we try to produce, when we're actually doing publication around our findings, we do it against the MITRE ATT&CK framework. That's a commonly used industry standard. And it gives us a basis for describing what we found and communicating to a whole breadth and scope of partners that we've had trouble in the past when we've all used different frameworks or different versions of the kill chains. So that has been something that we have adopted at scale, and we've adopted that across our vulnerability teams and our threat hunting teams to also ensure that we have common language between the two teams. So that when we bring findings back to headquarters and we're starting to kind of do that analysis of trending, things that we're finding at scale, how to produce more palatable and more actionable reports to whichever stakeholder group we're trying to hit, whether it's the water sector or the electric sector, or healthcare. It's big in the news right now. We're doing a lot of work around COVID vaccine manufacturers. We're trying to be as proactive as we can. But like Lauren said, everything has to be scoped. It has to be bounded. And we have to also be very clear with those that are experiencing the benefits of our threat hunting activity, what level of visibility they have allowed will also be a piece of how much guidance or what we can give them. You know, the more that we have access to as hunters, the better the hunt's going to be. But we very much understand and respect that we are an external body coming to do something on a very voluntary basis. And there's a level of comfort and trust that has to exist there that we talk through in the preparation phase about, you know, what is going to have the highest likelihood of finding something, what we're looking for, what our concern is. And, you know, things happen at different classification levels. So our goal in CISA is always to get everything down to the unclassified level where action can be taken. And when we can't do that, we have a really good reason for it. And we find other ways of getting around that in order to help those that we know require threat hunting services.
Excellent. And Grifter, so in the spirit of driving improvements, what are some of the areas? So certainly identifying that somebody's inside is key, but also we talked about identifying other things that could still put the company or the organization at risk. So driving improvements in detection and response, are you helping to say the technologies we have aren't up to snuff, we should reconsider something else, or our SOC isn't prepared to handle an attack if this were to succeed because we found X, Y, and Z? Do you get into helping to set new policies or even help to define changes to the architecture or the infrastructure?
I think, to a degree, what we're doing is just putting forward our recommendations, and whether or not somebody acts on those is up to them. My role at RSA is a little bit different because I am hunting for like our largest customers, essentially. Like I will go out into their environment and hunt with them. It used to be physically. I'd go physically out to their location and sit with their SOC teams and hunt through their data, trying to find the bad. And so, you know, I obviously can't affect what they do with that data once I leave, but I mean, the recommendations are there. The hunters, if they're internal, should definitely have that communication to the teams, if for nothing else, just for understanding about why decisions are made the way that they are, why the technologies that exist, were chosen, and, you know, being able to hopefully, I think it was Lauren who said, like, when you go out on a hunt, you always find something, right? It's really difficult not to find something. And I think as soon as you start finding things, it really it creates trust between you as a hunter and the other parts of the organization or the security team, who start to say, oh, wow, okay, you found a thing that we didn't even know was there. What should we do about that? And you get the chance to be that trusted advisor. We were talking about MITRE ATT&CK for a minute there, and we're like, I'm a huge fan of MITRE ATT&CK. We use MITRE ATT&CK all the time with RSA and on our hunts with RSA. Again, it's just quickly becoming the standard, right? That people all understand it. But there's also within MITRE ATT&CK, you can set up like a matrix that says, like, here are the technologies that are good for visibility for these types of attack techniques. So even those types of that type of advice or that type of visibility exists within MITRE ATT&CK itself. And so I'll often recommend that people go look there. I think both Alexis and Lauren mentioned earlier intelligence. And when we're talking about MITRE ATT&CK, that MITRE ATT&CK is full of the kind of intelligence that actually matters. I have gone in to consult organizations on their threat hunting programs. And when you get in there, they say like, oh, here's how we do our hunt. We get our intelligence feeds in the morning, and then we go search for those IOCs within the environment. And to me, that's not hunting. That's just, you know, Googling for IOCs. What's hunting is doing something like understanding what business you're in, understanding what assets you have and what threat groups are interested in those assets, and then understanding their tactics, techniques, and procedures so that you can go and look for evidence of those types of TTPs in your environment. And I think when you're setting up, we're talking about scope, when you're setting up a hunt, you can say, all right, we're going to go out if we are the type of organization that APT29 is interested in, we're going to, try to emulate. We'll get our red team, our offensive folks to emulate the behavior of APT29. And we're just going to see whether our blue team can detect that or where our detections fall down. It's using that type of intelligence to create scope and, actually affect real change in the environment. Because if you can't detect what your internal organization, the folks from internal, can do, then you're not going to be able to do it when it's a live situation. So all of those things, great points and really, really important to a hunt. But sorry, I rambled there for a second, but in reality, I guess the biggest thing is just trying to keep those lines of communication open between IT, security, the different roles within security, and foster that relationship rather than, IT often looks at security as the team that's always saying no. And what we need to do is have our hunters being those like ambassadors in between and saying, hey, why do we do things this way? And why do we choose these products and have that type of line of communication open? Because if it is, when inevitably you find a misconfiguration or you do have a recommendation, you'll have a relationship with that part of the team that when you make a recommendation, they're actually going to listen.
Yep, I love it. And that's a perfect segue for the point I'd like to kind of wrap up with here, which is that communication. And I think it can certainly be different in a government organization versus a service provider versus somebody who's running their own team. So I think we got a pretty good view from you, Grifter, on that. Lauren, I'd like to get your thoughts on the communications of threat hunting. Because, generally in security and risk, it's hard to translate the nitty-gritty technical bits into something that matters to somebody, right? And then there's layers between the hunter and the team managers and InfoSec and risk management and the business. So how do you establish communications and translate the data or the information that you find into something that the business really cares about?
Yeah, so I always say communication is like one of the number one skills that we have to work on as really technical people. So number one, if you're looking to get into threat hunting or looking to join a threat hunting team or looking to start a threat hunting team, either make sure the manager is good and understands both technical and business aspects. If you're looking to start a threat hunting team, make sure that you understand exactly what your executives are looking for with threat hunting. Because it could be that they just went to some random vendor's booth at, I'm going to pick on Neil here, at RSA, and heard somebody say, oh, threat hunting, it's like hot and shiny. And now they come back and are like, hey, Sean, I want you to start a threat hunting team. And they don't really know what that means. Woo-hoo. So make sure you establish those guidelines. What are they looking for? What are their expectations as executives? But then as you're going through the hunting process, for me, again, if you're taking good notes and you're documenting, I always send a weekly update if it's a particularly visible threat hunt. So I just conducted one that the board was interested in. Like, this was very specifically requested by several executives. And so there was a weekly email saying, hey, here's everything we did. Here was our findings, just letting you know, here are the problems we ran into. So-and-so couldn't get us a MFA token to test with or something like that. But then at the end, I always, always, always recommend when you finish a threat hunt, you have a readout. And that can be a readout with your team only. But what I generally recommend is at least your SOC or your IR or both, if you have both, and at least your red team or like whoever's doing vulnerability stuff in your org. And you might not have enough people for teams, but find the people who are already doing that so you can share your knowledge and your findings. Because most likely a lot of the things that you are recommending be improved are going to impact those teams, especially when we're talking adding new detections or alerts or new processes. And then just like be honest and open about what the risk actually is. And make sure you understand it. And this kind of goes back to Neil's point and Alexis's point about intelligence. Make sure you understand how widespread is this risk? How many people are seeing this? You know, when we talk about Mimikatz or when we talk about Ryuk, like that's the hot ransomware right now where they're measuring compromise time in hours, not months. That's scary and that's real. And you need to make sure you have the intel and data to back that up. And final piece of advice is just try to communicate your findings in a way that your grandma or your grandpa would understand. I tend to find that with executives, really the only thing they care about is money and how are we financially protecting the business. So I try to relate it to that. And then I also try to parse down the technical terms just a little bit to help explain what we did.
I wonder if my grandma knows what Ryuk and Mimikatz is. I don't know. Probably not.
Probably not.
Alexis, your thoughts on communications and setting and managing expectations as part of that?
Sure. I go back and forth. I'm with Lauren that we've made a very concerted effort over the past couple of years to cultivate communication skills within our threat hunting teams specifically. We call them engagement teams, but the teams that are actually deploying out or doing remote activities with a particular partner or entity that's requested help. But we also, we have a very large organization at DHS, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, and we've had to create exactly what Lauren has described of the way to describe very technical, very technical events and activities in non-technical ways, because our communications go, they go vertically, they go horizontally, they go every direction you can imagine. Our stakeholder pool is very large. Part of what our organization does is really digs into the governance structures, not just IT or security, but you know the entire kind of risk infrastructure that an organization or an infrastructure set, you know, healthcare as a big sector, understanding how to both amplify comms, how to ensure that the right information is getting to the right people. And I know that's an extremely generic way of describing what we try to do, but, you know, our three pillars are shareability, actionability, and timeliness. And that goes for all of our communications within cybersecurity. And if you can't explain what you found and why that particular entity that you've partnered with needs to be concerned. And oftentimes, if the United States government shows up and says, hey, I think you've got a problem, can we please come in and look? You probably got something going on that's not good. So we've really been working on that. But alongside communications, I really want to stress this as well. And it was in the Twitter post, and I liked seeing it there, was the ability of the threat hunting teams to recognize where their information needs, whether they're an immediate need because they're on site and they need something back from home base or from another part of the organization. This whole ability to operate as a very highly integrated team with back and forth pulls throughout the lifecycle of the engagement, if possible, has been critical for us at Homeland Security. We want to be in regular communication with our vulnerability teams, with SOCs, with other parts of the cybersecurity infrastructure. And then we establish reach back capabilities on the commercial side as well, so that if we're on site and we think we're seeing something or we're finding something and we need a little bit more detail, that ability for folks to both communicate and have kind of that innate coalition building that's already been done to set the stage for how to have all that information you're going to need to access very quickly and reliably while you are somewhere in someone else's infrastructure looking for something has been very, very important and something that we've put a lot of time and investment into making sure is accommodated through really very innovative ways over the past couple of years. And I look forward to working with the team and continuing to build that out.
Yeah, important stuff for sure. And we're glad you're there. I'm gonna turn to Neil now for a final word from him. I think we've got some really good tips from you, Lauren and Alexis. So Neil, just maybe a thought from you, kind of spanning multiple organizations. What do you see as a good piece of advice for them to take advantage of and really extract the most value out of threat hunting as they can?
Sure. I think it's probably pretty basic, and that is to don't be afraid of threat hunting. It sounds fancy and shiny, but in reality, it is just leveraging a lot of things that we've been doing for a very long time. And having expert threat hunters that are knowledgeable across a broad range of security is great, but your entry-level analysts can show value in a threat hunt as well. So please don't limit it only to your expert folks. Give your people time to hunt. Focus on the intelligence that is high on the pyramid of pain, and then just stand back and watch what they find. And I think you'll be amazed.
Great advice. I think a lot of the analysts want to be hunters anyway, right? So give them an opportunity. Well, listen, I could keep talking for hours, I'm sure. I think we'll wrap it here. I think I'm crushed a little bit because I envisioned this wild, wild west, gunslinging, free-for-all threat hunting. But clearly, this is an important part of the security program, and therefore has some pretty strong guidelines for how to run a threat hunting team and program. So
we still dress that way, Sean.
Yeah, it's I know you still that dress that way.
Yeah, we're just still sitting behind a keyboard.
Exactly. Well, listen, thank you, Alexis, Lauren, and Grifter for fabulous conversation. I'll include links to your profiles if that's all right, so folks can reach out to you if they want. And if you have any, I know we mentioned MITRE. If you have any other resources that you want to share with me, I'll include those in the show notes as well. Anything to help organizations kind of get a deeper view into threat hunting and how it can work for them, that would be great. So thank you all for joining.
Thanks for having us.
Nintex is the global standard for business process management and automation. The Nintex platform helps their clients accelerate progress on their digital transformation journeys by quickly and easily managing, automating, and optimizing business processes. Learn more at nintex.com. Imperva is the cybersecurity leader whose mission is to protect data and all paths to it with a suite of integrated application and data security solutions. Learn more at imperva.com. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.